even a little of this could be covered by Father because of prayer. And that's why...
Thank you.
That is why, you know, what I should be talking to you about, what I will be talking to you about here tonight, ideally would be the very last session together. Because then it really is just kind of a wrap-up. And in some ways, a review of everything that you've done here. We're not going through everything again, obviously. But kind of the culmination of all that. And so that's why the two forms that I just gave you, we're going to go over that here tonight. Hopefully I can get you out of here a little bit early. But I always say that, and then it ends up being the full hour and a half anyway. So don't hold me to this. Even what this section, these last four classes are all about, I mean, in some ways they might seem kind of anticlimactic. Everything happened on the Easter Vigil, and the whole year leading up to that, and then this is just, but it is, it's a kind of a, hopefully it was a spiritual high for you. We can have those spiritual highs, which are wonderful. But if, it's just like anything, if you're constantly at this like high level, you wear yourself out. And it really can take its toll on you. And so, on the other side of that, some people have, and they have some pretty big, highs and dips and lows. And that's not always really healthy either. To some extent, say, it'd be great if it was just this consistent steadiness. But you need those more exuberant moments than two. I mean, it's just like anything, on a job, you accomplish something really big. It's like, this is great. Or, then you have other days it's just a tedious task that you wish you could avoid. Just like a day-to-day activity, life in a family. You have some kind of celebration of an important event. And then the next day it's just kind of quiet. But it's kind of good to go back to that quiet, too. And so that's part of what these four Mondays, these last four Mondays are all about. Is hopefully that was a spiritual high at the Easter Vigil, and then you were celebrating Easter, you had Easter Monday off, and now we kind of come back down to more of this steady level here, but how do we keep that going, and how do it culminated everything you've been doing all since September, to Monday or to Saturdays ago, but that's not the end of it. Now you take this faith with you and you live it. And so that's kind of what these four sessions are all about, and this one being kind of the wrap-up of it all. So, it's living that experience, that too. And not just the Christian experience, because some of you were already Christian, but now the Catholic experience, specifically. And how to kind of immerse yourself fully into the Church. And that's, at least for most of you here, I think, that's part of the problem is for someone that's a convert to the faith, a lot of times they're on fire more than a lifelong Catholic. Because, you made a decision to do this, and you got this kind of adult presentation, too. So a lot of times they are just, kind of courageous about living their faith than a lifelong Catholic. That's not 100% true. I've known it, unfortunately, many converts who, even some shortly after, others a few years after, this all kind of died for them and kind of left the Catholic faith, or at least didn't practice it as like they should be doing. And then I've known, Catholics who kind of do the same thing, they just never really take it that seriously. And then I've known Catholics who just, are constantly on fire with the faith, which is wonderful. And then converts, sometimes even more so. But one of the things that a convert to the faith kind of loses or you didn't have a real experience of when you are a lifelong Catholic, and I was baptized as a baby as a Catholic, but so you don't have that culture. You're just introduced to the culture now, and so you didn't grow up with that. And so it is important, and that's we're going to touch on that here tonight. That's part of what we're doing here tonight is this. What is this Catholic culture, and how can and that's really the lived experience of it too. I mean, it's extremely important going to Mass and praying and going to confession. That was the whole thing with Divine Mercy yesterday. But it's more than just that too, and I mean it really is a way of life. and which is often, sadly, in contrast to the way the world is. And it seems that that world is just going further and further away from any kind of godliness. And in many ways, you know, any kind of sense of morality where almost anything goes. And so to, you know, truly to be Christian, truly to be religious, I mean, it started out of that, but truly to be religious, truly to be Christian, truly to be Catholic, you kind of stick out. And this is, in some ways, not anything new, but it just seems now even more so do we stick out if you really are trying to live your faith. And but what does that mean? And, you know, how do you do that? And so there are some expectations, and we've probably touched on some of this as we went through and the different topics that you've been, you know, hearing about over the course of the whole year. But that's where that the first sheet I gave you, the non-blue sheet, the white sheet, and particularly the precepts of the church. You'll see various these put various ways. Sometimes, you know, this thing is actually the seven. Some lists will be eight, and some you'll see five. And but it's really a matter of just how they kind of they all say the same thing. They just it's a how they combine things. So, but these are the things that you, it is expected that you'll be doing. Now, this is not the culture. I mean, the culture will be the last thing I do here tonight. But this is just how do we live this new found faith that we have here, and this is what every Catholic is bound to. Again, not everybody's faithful to it, and you know, obviously that's between us and God. But this is the expectation, and the reason it's an expectation is this is kind of the minimum thing we should be doing to live a holy life and to get to heaven. You know, that's the bottom line, get to heaven. And so what are we expecting? Again, I think you've probably heard all of this, but now you kind of get it in all one spot. If you haven't already seen it in one spot. But the first item is, and you know, this is just appropriate for this season that we're in right now, but it is to keep holy the day of the Lord's resurrection. Keep holy the Sabbath. And for the Jews, the Sabbath was Saturday. For us as Christians, it's Sunday, because that's the day Jesus rose from the dead. Celebrated that, you know, specifically two Sundays ago, and do that in some way here through this whole Easter season, and really every Sunday is a celebration of that. And but that means then, again, minimally, that we go to Mass every Sunday or Saturday night, because we do the vigil, and to fulfill that obligation. And it is an obligation, but it's one that, again, I talked about this when I was speaking about the Eucharist. You know, it is an obligation to go to Mass, but we receive that grace to live that faith and to deal with all the problems in the world and to have that courage to kind of stand out when we have to. And so, you know, there's a benefit here too, but it is an obligation. It's how we honor our Lord. And, you know, most Christians will say, yeah, it's good to keep, they'll all say it's good to keep the Lord's Day holy, but how does that, or what does that mean specifically? And for us as Catholics, it means, again, minimally going to Mass. Because at Mass, we get that grace, we honor God, and we associate with one another, even if you don't have a lot of interaction with people. And but you're, you know, sitting there with, I mean, depending on the church that you go and the Mass that it is, I mean, here, I mean, there's very few Sunday Masses that we probably don't have 200-300 people or more. And but I know, you know, you go to some churches and some kind of dying areas, or, you know, cities that are, Pennsylvania is a good example, where, you know, cities are just some of these, you know, where there were coal mines that are shut down or factories that have been eliminated. You know, a lot of those towns are just dying, and they had, you know, like eight churches, a small little town, and now what many bishops have done is closed a number of them, and maybe they had eight, now they got three, or maybe even just one. because they get 20, 30 people at one church, and, you know, and you got them spread over eight churches. And sometimes there's not the priestly personnel to do that. So and we're very blessed in our diocese here that it's still growing. And we're not the only one. And North Carolina is another really good example of that, too, where the faith is just growing. And they're building churches. You know, sadly, in places like a lot of places, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, where I come from, it's not as bad, probably. I mean, there's not these cities that are just being shut down. But there's been a lot of churches that have shut down, Catholic churches that have been closed. And because he got some of these, especially in inner cities like Milwaukee, and you know, oftentimes there's not a lot of Catholics there. And so you have these beautiful churches, and on a Sunday they'll have 10, 15 people, that's it, that come to Mass. And so can you justify having, and you know, blocks away, there's another church, another Catholic church. And so what has happened, like the parish where my dad grew up in, it's now, that there were five churches in this area. It's the inner city now, and sadly it's a very crime-ridden and everything else. But there were five churches that they combined down to one. And even that one, I don't think it's a lot of participation like that. But again, here, we're building churches. And so, I mean, it really is a blessing. And again, there are other, you know, exceptions to what I'm just talking about here as well. But expectation is, so, you know, here you're going to associate with a lot of other people. But, you know, another issue, and there's a little bit on the cultural side of that. I remember my very first parish that it was St. Michael's in Annandale, which actually, in our diocese, that's one of them, is the demographics of that parish has changed considerably. When I was there, that's 30 years ago. But our school had about 550 kids in it. The parish was thriving. But that area now of Annandale has become very Asian, Korean, and a lot of, I mean, there are Catholic Koreans, definitely, but there are a lot that are not. And so a lot of them that moved into that area are not Catholic. And so that church, I think, seated 1,400 or 1,500. And it has a balcony and everything. They have completely blocked off the balcony. They don't want even, so they don't have to, you know, clean it up every Sunday, whatever. Because there's never anybody, they don't need the space. When I was there, we filled that whole church. And now they only have like 120 kids in their school. So, you know, that is one example, and there's probably one or two other ones in our diocese where, you know, they've definitely lost people. But that's an exception in our diocese. Again, thankfully. But, I remember when I left there, and I used to hear occasionally, so, you know, there are a lot of people, but, I always found it to be a friendly place, but some of the parishioners didn't think it was all that friendly. And I remember, and this was a few weeks before I was leaving that parish, we had a funeral for a guy who was the husband. This couple had been members of that parish for a long time, very involved, and the husband died, and I had done the funeral. And I remember the wife telling me afterwards how, you know, just what a beautiful, wonderful parish this was, and how these people had just, you know, been so supportive of her with the death of her husband, and just how much she just loves St. Michael's. And again, it's interesting because I didn't always hear that from people. But here was a woman and her husband that were very involved in the parish. They were involved in organizations. And so they met all these people through all this involvement that they were a part of. And, you know, if you just come in late, attend Mass, leave a little bit early, you're doing your minimum. But you're not going to meet people. And you're going to think the place is kind of unfriendly. You know, on the other hand, you know, we have coffee and donuts after most Masses. We did on Easter Sunday. Yesterday. And, in fact, it was a pancake breakfast. It wasn't coffee and donuts. It was pancake breakfast. But you know, there's an opportunity to socialize with people. We're going to have a speaker this coming Saturday night. You know, there's an opportunity to associate with people. We have, you know, our St. Patrick's, St. Joseph's Day party. We just had that a few Saturday nights ago. We have our annual Oktoberfest. It's usually the last Sunday in September, because it follows the German one, which actually starts in September. It's 3 weeks long. It's the last 2 weekends and the last 2 weeks in September and the first week in October. I think it's the way the German Munich Oktoberfest runs. But some people say, why do you have Oktoberfest in September? Well, we found a little German thing. And but again, I mean, these are just a few examples of opportunities to socialize. And we're going to look at more ways to get involved here at the end as well. But but that is part of it, just even being at Mass. So I mean, if you come in and then you leave and you talk to people as you're walking out, That's how you get to know people. And people seem to be somewhat creatures of habit. That again, a number of people, not everyone. Sometimes it's based on schedules, or it can vary week to week. But it seems majority of the people, they have their favorite mass. They go and maybe it's just because it works the best at that time. They go to that mass. They probably have their favorite spot in the church too, and unfortunately that sometimes can work against the person, because I've heard people, how dare that person sit in my spot? Well, it's like your name's not on there, but I guess you can come a little bit earlier and get your spot. But people are just, again, kind of creatures of habit. But that's why it's interesting too, people that do have that, they know who sits around them too, and then they know if they're not there. And I'll get questions, and I haven't seen so-and-so for 3 weeks. Do you know anything about them? Are they sick or something? But you build that kind of fellowship with people. And I'll be honest with you. Probably some of the Protestant churches center around that more than what Catholic churches typically do. But the underlying reason there is, while that fellowship is important and very helpful, for us, the most significant thing is the Eucharist. And for a lot of the Protestant churches, some never have a communion service. And so that's not the emphasis. The emphasis is the Scriptures, which is good, and fellowship. For us, it's the Eucharist first and foremost, and the graces that flow from that, and then some of these other things. So that's why, again, Sunday is the day. And we're also, the other side of that too, on the Catholic perspective here, is that comes right from God. We need a day of rest, and I know a lot of people, that's the day they get all their household activities done or duties done, because they don't have time the rest of the week. And if you don't, because you're so busy, you might be forced to do that. Maybe you're too busy then too, and maybe there's things you can change. But you can get some of these duties done on Saturday, and really rest on Sunday and spend time with the family, and maybe some additional little prayer things that you can fit into the schedule. And that's why what it says here, you should try to avoid needless work or business activities or unnecessary shopping. It doesn't mean you can't shop, and it doesn't mean certainly that you can't go out for dinner or something like that. I know I run into, you run into all kinds of people, but we've had some, because it is a day of rest, and there are, they call them blue laws, where places are closed on Sunday, and there are certain, a lot of those are long gone, but in some states there were blue laws that most businesses were closed on Sunday, out of respect for, the Judeo-Christian founding of our country here. And interestingly enough, though, in Wisconsin, not here in Virginia, but in Wisconsin, auto dealerships, car businesses, have to be closed on Sunday.
Texas
also. Okay. Not in Virginia, they can be open. But that's one of where the blue law still is in effect. There might be other states, too. I don't know. But it's just kind of interesting, how that is. But I've had people tell me, you shouldn't be going out for dinner. Well, that can be a recreational activity, and realizing somebody's going to make that dinner in that restaurant. That is allowed. Maybe not the best thing. I don't know. But stores being open, sometimes that can actually be a nice family activity, depending on what the family likes. Now, if it's drudgery, you shouldn't do it on Sunday. Because, again, it's supposed to be this day of rest. It's supposed to be a day for God, for family. So that's the first item. Second item is leading a sacramental life. And so you are required to go to Mass every holy day. Every Sunday and holy day. We're going to look at the holy days in a moment here, too. That's on the back of the sheet here. I didn't mention that in the first number one here. So you're not required to go to communion every Sunday. Actually, you're only required to go to communion once a year. That you're required to do this. Why not go every Sunday if you're in the state of grace and get that extra grace that you do from the Eucharist? It's kind of old thinking that I'm never worthy to receive Holy Communion. There were some people that had that perspective. that I am not worthy to receive Jesus. And they would not receive Jesus. They would not receive the Eucharist. They wouldn't receive, ever receive Holy Communion. So the church put into effect that you had to receive at least once a year. And but that's where this thing came from. And it doesn't say this here. Well, it says, you know, receive frequently. But again, it is. And then communion and going to confession, both of those you are to receive or do at least once a year. Now, confession, you know, the church recommends monthly. It can be more frequently, but at least once a year, recommends monthly. And, you know, Holy Communion, I mean, so Mass every Sunday, unless you're sick, you know, have one of the reasons to be excused. Or you know, you're working from morning to evening and can't get there Saturday night because you might be working too. Like a nurse that works, you know, 2 12-hour shifts or something on Saturday and Sunday, you may not be able to get to Mass, and then you are excused. But otherwise, the obligation is to be there. And then holy days as well, but to receive communion at least once a year. And we do have to be in the state of grace. We talked about all that. You know, no mortal sin on our soul. And there's all this other preparation for that. But you know, fasting for 1 hour before and everything. But otherwise, you know, why not receive every Sunday if you fulfill all those obligations? But you must do it at least once a year. And actually, it's supposed to be during the Easter time, not the Easter season. So the Easter season began Holy Saturday night, and it will end on Pentecost Sunday, which is about 6 Sundays from now. 5 Sundays from now, probably. But the Easter time is from Ash Wednesday until Trinity Sunday, which is the Sunday after Pentecost, one Sunday after. And so that's about 13 weeks of time. It's over 13 weeks, almost 14 weeks. And so once during there, you're supposed to go to confession and go to communion, at least. Ideally, you know, more frequently. You got 3 more sessions, presuming that you show up here, that it fits your schedule. But, you know, that's the... I mean, you can always take this again next year or 3 years from now, or if you think you need a refresher, you're welcome to do that. You're not required to do that by any means. But what you are required to do is to continue to inform yourself, to kind of, you know, stay on top of your faith here and to read, and I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about this in a few minutes too, but you know, to read some Catholic publications, books, but to really kind of continue, you know, deepening your faith and knowledge of the faith beyond when this ends here, 3 weeks from now. And so that's what 3 is here. 4, if you're not currently married and, you know, thinking that that's your vocation, it is expected, if you're now a Catholic, that you'd be married in the Catholic Church. Now, you can get some exceptions to that, but the bishop is the one that has to give you that exception. And or this would apply to, you know, if your kids are Catholic, and I know that's a huge problem in today's world again too, where a lot of kids, young people are not very religious, kind of rejected that, don't get married in the church, and don't want to be married in the church, don't want to have God as part of their lives, and it's unfortunate. So you have to pray for that. But that is the expectation. Is that you'll be married in the Catholic Church. And then it varies diocese to diocese what the bishop will do in regards to that. Like here, and it's, I mean, since I've been ordained 30 years ago, there was always it's called a dispensation, that the bishop has to give permission to a Catholic to be married in a non-Catholic setting. And, and Bishop Keating, so I've been under 3 bishops now. Bishop Keating was the first. Well, we were founded in 1972, our diocese. Bishop Welch was the first bishop, so there's been 4 bishops. But I had met him, but he was no longer bishop here. He had moved up to Pennsylvania, diocese there, Allentown. And then he retired from that, and he's now deceased. But Bishop Keating was the second bishop. He's the one who ordained me. And he's actually now deceased as well. But his policy was, you if you're going to, if there's a Catholic involved, obviously, but if there's a Catholic involved and you're marrying someone who's not Catholic, he would allow you to marry in that person's church or even another church if they, that was what you chose. But it had to be a sacred place. So it could be a temple, a mosque, a synagogue, or a non-Catholic Christian church. But he required a sacred place. Bishop Laverde was our third bishop, and who retired now just about 5 years ago, I think it is. And he's still around. He'll be here, in fact, next Tuesday night, a week from tomorrow, for a confirmation for our eighth grade. But, so he's still active. But his policy was that if there was a non-baptized party marrying a Catholic, he would allow them to be married actually in any setting. I mean, it could be a church. Now, if it was two Christians, a Catholic and a baptized non-Catholic, it had to be a sacred setting again. But he allowed, if it was a Catholic and a non-baptized party, they could be married in a park or, a hotel room, whatever. But his requirement was the priest could not do the ceremony. It had to be the Protestant minister then or whoever it's going to be. But it couldn't be the priest. That was his policy. Bishop Burbage is our current one for the last 5 years. He will, even in that last... So if it's a Catholic and a non-Catholic Christian, his strong preference is that you be married in a church. If there seems to be some serious circumstance, he'll consider it. But it would need to be a really serious reason to be married in a non-sacred setting. A Catholic and a non-baptized party, he will allow them to be married in a non-sacred setting, again, like that hotel or country club or whatever it is. And he will allow the priest to do it in that setting if there's strong circumstances. And I actually had an example of that. I was married. So, they will say otherwise. But Seventh-day Adventists, they don't get baptized the way we do. The mainstream Christians. The Roman Catholic Church, does not consider Seventh-day Adventists to be Christian. Because their concept of baptism is very different from what the rest of the Protestant and Catholic perspective is on baptism. So, the groom was Seventh-day Adventist. His parents were very devout Seventh-day Adventists. To the point that if he got married here to the bride, who was Catholic and a parishioner here, if he was to get married here, his parents would not come to the ceremony. They would not step into a Catholic church. And so that was the circumstances. I presented that to the bishop. And the bride worked for one of these big hotels. One of the kind of it's in Tyson's.
Sheraton Premier, that's a big one.
No, it's right attached to the Galleria mall.
I think it's the Sheraton Premier.
I think it's a Hyatt or it's not a Hilton. I think it's Hyatt Regency. Yeah, Hyatt Regency. I think that's what it is. I think
Ritz-Carlton.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. That's it. She worked for them, and that's when she got married. And I did the wedding, but with the bishop's permission because of this situation with the groom's parents. So, again, that's the... and then if you are Catholic again, too, the expectation is that you will get your children baptized Catholic and raise them to the best of your ability in the faith as well. And that means putting them, either homeschooling them, putting them in a CCD program if they're not going to come to their school, or in a Catholic school. You're sitting in one of the classrooms right now. So one of the three options. But raising them in the faith. And then five is expected to do your best to kind of support the church. And that can mean financially. And, you know, that's actually, to be honest, Protestants are typically much better at that than what the Catholics are. They're much more faithful to that 10% rule, and which is tithing is scriptural, and that's where they, you know, pick that up from. But you know, again, that's very different on the Catholic side of things here. I remember one of my sisters, she's married a dairy farmer, so they had their dairy farm, and land that was adjacent to their part of their farmland. They rent this kind of non-denominational church, kind of a revivalist type of church, rented a piece of property from their neighbors, and literally they put up a tent, first of all. That's where they were holding their church services every Sunday. Then they eventually actually built, I don't know if they bought the land or what they did, but they ended up building a church there. And so some of her neighbors joined it because it was convenient. But she was shocked. They had to give the church their W-2 form so that they would know what 10% of their salary was, and that had to go to the church. I don't know if any Catholic church has ever asked for that. So, again, that's, you know, how seriously some of these people take. But you know, so that, I mean, that is scriptural. The Catholic, it's more of a guideline, is to use that 10% that you ideally would be giving away 10% to charity. And the Catholic Church suggests half of that to your parish or other Catholic, you know, like the Bishop's Lenten Appeal, which is this annual thing to help the diocese. And so, you know, those kind of things, that 5% would go to that, 5% of your income. Of course, then you get into, is it taxable income? All these crazy things. People have their ways of dealing with this. But the general guideline, again, is 10%. The church says give 10% away, ideally. Half of that to Catholic-related things, the other half to another worthy charity or charities that you want to contribute to. So that's the support of that. And then, you know, we just finished this year, but number six is abstaining from meat. We abstain from meat technically every Friday. That is still the rule. Actually, the exception was this past Friday. We did not need to abstain from meat on that Friday because it was during that Easter week again, that octave. It was all a big celebration. So we're excused from it that day. But otherwise, we're supposed to do it every Friday, and people think, you know, it's only during Lent. Well, what the church changed in 1968, I think it was it said that, you know, there were people, so, and I'll be honest with you, here's one of the cultural things again. I mean, you knew who Catholics were because they didn't eat meat on Fridays. And, you know, that's like a place in Wisconsin, which was heavily Catholic. Every place had a fish fry. I mean, like, you know, you could go to the local tavern, which never, in Wisconsin, you don't have to serve food in the taverns. And so they would not have food all week long, but Friday night they had a fish fry. Because otherwise they wouldn't get anybody coming here. And it's interesting, there's a business school study done, like a marketing type of thing, test case, or one of these textbook cases. It was actually Olive Garden. And when Olive Garden came to Wisconsin, so that was a number of years ago, when they came to Wisconsin, you know, Friday night was always a big night for them, Friday and Saturday night, and they saw their business drop considerably on Friday nights. And they thought this was very strange, you know, that this was a unique phenomenon for them. So they, of course, researched that and found out everybody was going to their fish fry. They didn't have a fish fry, so people that weren't coming to Olive Garden on Friday nights, they added a fish fry in Wisconsin, and so that people would come to their restaurant. But so there's one of those cultural things. So you knew what Catholic was. It was a, you know, it at times could be a little bit of a burden, but it was a binding thing. And so again, back in 68, the church realized, though, too, it was meant to be sacrificial. Okay. Jesus died on the cross for us on Friday. He gave his life. We were supposed to do something. And so the church made it easy. Give up meat. And so again, that was a common bond that we all had. But then they realized too, there were some people, it really wasn't a sacrifice. You know, they would have lobster, and unless you love or hate lobster, and that was a sacrifice. You know, where is the sacrifice here? So the church said, we'll maintain the tradition, give up meat during the Fridays of Lent. The rest of the year, you can still do that. That's still the rule, but you can choose something else to give up if that's not a sacrifice for you. You know, if you prefer to eat lobster, we'll have lobster, but then give up something else. And so that's, but right now, you know, the Fridays of Lent, we are still supposed to give up meat. And that's why, you know, there's another little marketing thing here again. Actually, I think it's, I don't know, there's at least two. Might be Wendy's. Or maybe it's even Chick-fil-A. I don't know who it was. But I know Popeyes does not serve a fish sandwich. And except during Lent. They, in my opinion, they have the best fish fry. Best fish sandwich. It's a, what is it? It's flounder. Yeah. And instead of like that pressed fish that McDonald's, I mean, I know a lot of people like that fish fillet, but it's not my favorite. But I think Popeyes, but and I wish they would have it more frequently because I would order. But they don't, only during Lent. And but that's why, again, you know, they're actually accommodating, particularly the Catholics, but there are some other Christians that follow that as well. And so Fridays of Lent and then Ash Wednesday. We only have 2 days of fasting now, and that is Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. And fasting means at the maximum one meal, no snacking. You may have two kind of small meals, like if, you know, if you eat your full meal at lunch, then you could have a little something for breakfast and a little something for dinner, but you know, it should not total another meal. And you can be more strict about it because it's supposed to be a day of serious fast. Only 2 days a year. That's all we're required to do as Catholics. Interestingly enough, the Orthodox still maintain the old tradition of the Catholic faith, which was they gave up meat all during Lent, all 40 days, the exception being the 6 Sundays. You could eat meat on Sundays. And actually it was considered that you should be fasting and abstaining all of Lent except the Sundays. And it was not just give up meat, it was any meat product. So anything that came from what the meat came from. So that meant eggs, that meant cheese, that meant butter, ice cream, I mean, you know, any of the dairy products, they come from a cow, the eggs from a chicken. And so it was very strict. People lost, Catholics lost a lot of weight during Lent, despite, you know, happenstances over here. But again, they did away with all. They made it much, much easier for us. So that's why, with such minimal laws now, it is important that we try to maintain that. And then the last thing is to join in the missionary spirit of the church, and that's what we're going to kind of launch into in a few seconds here, you know, some of the other issues here. But just to refer you to the back of that sheet, so you got this chart here, Holy Days of Obligation. So this is a universal chart. It is. You'll see the very last line there, or you know, column, is in the United States. And so, like, if you were in Italy, they follow all. They let's see. I don't know if it actually was Italy. No, it doesn't. Not specifically. But if you were in Italy, they follow all of these holy days, just as it's marked on here. They don't do the St. Patrick's, as you'll notice. That's only in Ireland. That's a holy day of obligation, St. Patrick's Day. Here, it's big, you know, feast day for a lot of people. Means they can drink green beer and eat corned beef. But in Ireland, it's a holy day of obligation, but only there, not including Italy. But the rest, all those days are holy days of obligation in Italy. As you'll see in the United States, we currently, here in our diocese, only have 5. And that's with the parentheses around that 1. So the 5 extra days that we have to go to Mass besides Sunday are January 1st, which which is the feast of Mary, the Mother of God. And then I'll come back to Ascension Thursday, but then we'll drop further down there, August 15th, the Assumption, November 1st, All Saints Day, December 8th, Immaculate Conception, and of course, December 25th, Christmas. Ascension Thursday, which would be coming up here, it's 40 days after Easter, is when Jesus literally, because the scripture says, 40 days after he rose, he ascended into heaven. And that was a holy day of obligation for us in the United States, across the country, for most of the time. But some of the states got permission from the Vatican, from Rome, the Pope, to dispense that. And it started out on the West Coast, and it moved east. And our diocese was one of the last to dispense from that. And it's been since I've been ordained with Bishop Laverty, so he came in 1999. I don't remember what year that was. It was probably 2002, 2003, somewhere in there, when that was dispensed for us here. Starting Baltimore and moving north of the whole East Coast, so Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Maine, I mean, all the way up the East Coast, they still require Ascension Thursday as a holy day of obligation. All those dioceses north of, or starting with Maryland, north, but not Washington, not Arlington. And again, we were two of the last. And then actually, interestingly enough, Washington, are in Arlington here, and Florida. We're the last ones to dispense with it. But you go further north, and they all have to still go. So it's interesting. If you were out there, and let's say you're from New York, and you go to Mass on Ascension Thursday, because it's a holy day of obligation for you, and then you're down here visiting, you go to Mass on that Sunday, the seventh Sunday of Easter, you get the Ascension readings again, so they would get the same readings that they had gotten on Thursday, and the celebration of it, because it's moved to the seventh Sunday, which would be the last Sunday of until Pentecost is next week, of Easter. So that's the list. Real quickly, on the other side, these are some of the things that we should, how we kind of live that faith, lived experience again here. Not all the cultural stuff yet. These are just, how do we kind of live our faith here? We should work on those virtues, the theological and cardinal virtues. The theological are the ones that are directly tied to God, faith, hope, and charity. In order to have faith in God, we're supposed to deepen that faith. We should, and with God, there's always hope. And then there's charity and love. I mean, we're supposed to love God, we're supposed to love our neighbor, and everything that means. And we'll get into some of what that does mean in a second here. But then, beyond that, and these are like secondary, but very serious nonetheless, the four cardinal virtues. And cardinal means hinge. You might think cardinal means whatever it might mean to you, but it comes from the word hinge. And so all other virtues hinge on these four. And so just prudence, exercising that. Trying to be wise about your way you live. Be just. Have that courage, that fortitude. And then self-control, temperance. So we're to exercise those virtues then too. I'm not going to go over the seven gifts or seven or 12 fruits of the Holy Spirit. You would have gotten that when it talked about confirmation. But now, how do we put the charity, love, into action? By works of mercy. And there are seven corporal and seven spiritual. And these are the things that, the corporal affect the body, the spiritual affect the soul. And so, feed the hungry. And that can mean all kinds of things. That could mean give to a charity that literally feeds the hungry. It could mean taking a meal over to a neighbor that just had a death in the family or a new baby or something, and you're just helping them out that way. Giving drink to the thirsty, kind of the same thing.
clothing the naked. You know, it could be giving to some kind of clothing drive. It might even be helping a neighbor by washing their clothes, their laundry for them, and ironing them or whatever. You know, I mean, just something simple like that. Sheltering the homeless. Now, this could literally mean, you know, giving to like a homeless shelter, or inviting somebody. I'm probably not wise to invite a stranger into your home. Some people do that. If you feel comfortable doing that, be careful, be prudent. But it's an option. But again, certainly like a family member that's kind of stranded temporarily or something, you know, that would certainly mean that. Visiting the sick, you know, stopping at a hospital or a nursing home is a good example. Even, and that's, you know, we have 5 nursing homes now in our parish boundaries that we serve. You know, it's sad. Some of these places, they never have visitors. Others always got visitors. And but it's very sad. Now, sometimes they're here and they don't have anybody nearby. That can be a problem, obviously. But, you know, sometimes, I mean, they'll talk, they'll tell us about it. I mean, some of their children live nearby and never come to visit them. And that's sad. So never know. If it's something, maybe it was a neighbor that's now in a nursing home. You go to visit, you might be their only visitor. Visiting in prison, you can't just walk into a prison typically, but it can be imprisoned in different ways too. You know, somebody that's just really struggling and you're there to support them. And then burying the dead. Again, you know, attending a funeral, helping a family member. You know, that's another sad thing that we run into frequently, is today anyways. Somebody dies here, elderly person, very devout, know they would want a Catholic funeral. Their kids have kind of left the faith, don't want a Catholic funeral. And we can't force them to do that. But it's just kind of sad when you know that that's probably what the parents would have wanted. So, you know, that kind of that concept as well. Then the spiritual works of mercy, so again, they deal with the soul. So counseling the doubtful, you know, so you meet somebody that is really struggling with, you know, all kinds of doubts about God or about faith in general or whatever it might be. So, you know, trying to talk to them. Or, you know, just informing, you know, and then sadly, I mean, hopefully you have a new perspective on that, if that was where you were. But some people have a really kind of, you know, crazy idea of what Catholics teach. And so that's the instructing of the ignorant, help people to know the truth. Admonishing sinners, you know, I mean, we start with ourselves. We're not perfect either. We got to work on that. But, you know, especially a family member, a loved one, you know, telling them if they're doing something wrong in a charitable, you know, hopefully constructive way. Comforting the afflicted, again, being there for people that are really struggling with whatever it might be. Forgiving offenses. You know, yesterday is all about divine mercy, God's mercy, His forgiveness of us. He expects us to forgive others too. And so to try to do that. And then bearing wrongs patiently. You know, that's another thing people don't like to do much anymore. You know, kind of accepting the sufferings that come. Now, that doesn't mean you got to be a doormat. But at the same time, not getting just completely upset if things don't go the way you want them to, or people don't treat you the way that you think they should. And then praying for the living and the dead. You know, pray for one another. Pray for your loved ones. Maybe pray for co-workers or, you know, any, I mean, just all the crazy stuff going on in the world. And then pray for the souls that have died, the people who have died. 7 capital sins, just quickly to go over these here. You know, these are not the worst sins, but they lead to worse sins. So, you know, pride, although pride is usually considered to be the worst sin because it leads to some, you know, where you think you're better than someone else. And then you can treat them poorly. And, you know, so greed or covetousness. Again, you could even decide to steal whatever. Lust, I mean, that can lead to all kinds of things. Anger can lead to, you know, trying to even kill someone. Gluttony, it just is, again, you know, whether it's drink or food or sleep or social devices, media, electronic devices, you know, any overuse of any of that kind of stuff. Envy, I mean, that can really cause people a lot of problems too. And then sloth, laziness. You know, we gotta be working at our faith. So that's just kind of an overview for you there. Let's see here before I get into the cultural stuff. If there's anything else? Well, just, and then this will kind of lead us into that then too. But it's the idea of spreading the faith.
And, you know, living it and being an example. And that does not mean standing on a soapbox outside, you know, the on Centerville Road here and preaching the gospel to people. I guess you could do that if you want to. But, you know, that's not the Catholic expectation. Even at, again, in the workplace, I mean, you don't have to, you know, like preach to everyone and, you know, try to convert everyone to Catholicism now. Actually, I had an example from that first parish in that St. Michael's. There was a woman, she worked for the post office in Annandale. And she worked in the post office. She was a sorter. And she had a cubicle, though, and very devout woman. Very, very devoutly Catholic. And but she told me the story of it, which is probably a little over the top. But she just literally had the thing completely plastered with Catholic stuff. You know, whether it was statues sitting around, pictures of saints and everything all over the cubicle. And she had, and I don't remember, it was a guy, I know that, but I don't remember what his story was. But he worked the cubicle next to hers, and he was very offended by all that stuff. And the way she just, she had a picture of it, so she showed me a picture. And again, it was kind of over the top. You know, one of my brothers, he retired early, but he had his, you know, computer screen thing. I mean, he had a little statue of the Blessed Mother sitting on top of it. Nobody ever said a word to him about it. But this woman, again, she had it in plaster. So her supervisor, after this neighboring, you know, cubicle person complained, said she had to take everything down. And she was really upset about that. And contested it to the local postmaster. The postmaster, he had some hesitation, but said, you know, this is, and again, it was in your face to some extent. I mean, she was sincere about this, but it just, I could see where somebody thought it was over the top. And but the local postmaster was just, I mean, I think he was a little bit on her side, but just thought it was over the top, so said, no, you know, it's got to go. And so she appealed to the postmaster general, and he actually overturned it and allowed her to have all that stuff. And then she put even more stuff. So, not sure that's the answer to that, but it's, not sure how charitable that was, but you know, the point being that, you know, so not necessarily to that level, but we are supposed to, you know, wear our faith on our sleeves, as they say, and, you know, not try to hide this. Now, again, you don't have to stand on that soapbox on the street corner, you know, in the workplace, or, you know, wherever you normally kind of function, but we are supposed to live the faith and let that speak for itself. There's some debate whether it was actually St. Francis of Assisi or someone else, but someone said, and again, a lot of people think it was Francis of Assisi, but some say they don't think it was him, but he had this line. He said, preach the gospel always, use words if necessary. So just that example, how we live, that we actually, you know, we do care about others. We're not, you know, trying to control our language, not being mean to others, not talking about others, gossiping and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, just really trying to live the faith and put it into practice. And in that way, help others understand that we love Christ, and that He's the center of our lives, and could be for them too. You know, in that sense, just a little analogy here. You know, if you think of the different kind of balls that we use in sports, you know, think of a tennis ball, a golf ball, a basketball, a soccer ball, a softball, a baseball, hardball. You know, any of these kind of balls, they all look a little different. That's why, you know, it's a soccer ball versus a basketball versus a baseball. But they all have that same shape. There's one ball that doesn't. Football. I mean, we call it a ball too, but it looks entirely different. And it's, you know, set for the game, so you can more easily kick it. You can tuck it under your arm as you run with it, if you catch a pass. again, it's designed for that sport, but it's different. And that's, in a sense, what we are, is we're kind of like that football. We're still a ball, we're still part of this world, but we are a little different. Our faith is fit to help us grow in holiness and get to heaven. And in that sense, we meet the general criteria, but we're different. And living that faith. And of course, how we do that is some of this cultural stuff that I said we're going to get into. And then we'll finish up with how you get involved. So, and again, I grew up with this here, so this is my life. Most of you are, this is going to be new for you, so I'm going to cover all this in 10 minutes, but there's a lot more involved here than what the little things that I'm going to be covering. But, just things that are connected with the seasons of the year. So, go back 3 months ago, Advent, Advent calendar, and although that's become somewhat popular too for a lot of people. And of course now you get the things with chocolates behind it and everything. But a religious Advent calendar. It's wonderful to have that in your home, with kids especially. They love to pop those little doors. Each day is the countdown to Christmas. Or the Advent wreath. And we usually have somebody that will have those available downstairs in the hall during right before Advent. The wreath with the four candles, and then you can actually get this little booklet with family prayers to say each of the Sundays when you light that candle for that one of those four Sundays leading up to Christmas, the four Sundays of Advent. During Easter here now, or during Lent, we have Stations of the Cross. We do that on Friday nights. We have confessions available from 6:30 to 7:30. The stations available at 7 o'clock in church. And we did our Lenten meals in the hall downstairs before that then. So you were here, we were supposed to be here, I think, for the practice. But for the practice for RCIA that evening, 2 o'clock. But at noon that day, we blessed Easter foods. So people bring their baskets in, and they got them. I mean, there's some that come every year. We had this one woman. She literally gets a block of butter and tries to carve a lamb out of it. She brings that. They're colored eggs. They're meats. They're sausages. They're wine. They're breads. Again, it's whatever anybody wants to bring. But you have those all blessed. There's a special blessing for each kind of category of food, tying it in with what was happening during Lent. And so that's another example. Then we have Candlemas. That's actually February 2nd. It completes the old. So Christmas used to be, but now it's over in about 3 weeks or less. This year I think it was 2 weeks. But the old one, the old tradition there was it was 40 days like Lent. But Easter season is 7 weeks long. Christmas was 40 days long, and from December 25th, 40 days later, February 2nd. And so that's the presentation of our Lord in the temple when the light of the world was shown to the world. So we bless candles at that Mass, and people take those home and have them in their home. I remember, there's red boxes, it's the same box. My mother was collecting these when I was a little child, and it was the same box that my mother used 50 years ago. It has two candles in it, and she got one every year. We had it, and they were all in our linen closet, because she thankfully didn't have to use it very often, but people would bring it out like during a storm, and just to kind of be symbolic of Christ's presence in the midst of this kind of horrible thing that's facing, or if there's some kind of family crisis, people would bring out that candle and light it. And as again, a reminder that Christ is with us, helping us through this difficult time right now. And so, just something like that. I'll be very honest with you, very few people have these anymore, but there is, they used to call them sick kit crucifixes. So it was a crucifix, but it's thicker than this. The thing, it actually slides open, and then you can, where the actual crucifix is, and where the body of, you know, the corpus of Jesus, and then there's a, so then once it slides open, there's it's hollowed out, and usually in there's holy water, there's a white cloth, candles, and if you had a homebound person and the priest was bringing communion to them, I mean, every Sunday, this Sunday I took it to three people. It's usually two or three. That's a short list that I got here. But I take communion to their homebound. They can't leave the house. They're elderly. They're all elderly. They're all sickly. But I mean, none of them do this. It's just almost never done anymore. But that was the old tradition. They would have that sick kit, crucifix, sitting on like a table that wherever you were going to meet them, they would put up the cross, the corpus piece into, because there was like a slot that slid into then when she slid it out, and then they would, that white cloth they put on the table, they'd light two candles, there's little holes for on the two ends of the, as you slide it open, you put those candles in, they light it as you brought the Eucharist to their home, then you would put your picks, that's what they call the container that we carry the host into to the homebound or to the hospital, wherever I might be going, nursing homes. But you would put it on that white cloth as you say the prayers, and you give them communion, and then they had there's a little bottle of holy water in there usually that you've been blessed up with. And then we'd leave, and they would close up the whole thing then. I mean, it's just another little thing, which is almost never done anymore. But my mom had one of those. I mean, they had that, it was in their bedroom. But also just that idea of statues and crucifixes, it's a tradition in every bedroom to have one over the bed. A lot of houses will put one over their front door in the inside, but over the door. In other words, as you're leaving, you're going with Christ. You see him as you're walking out. And that reminder of him is not literally Jesus, obviously. And we don't have one in here. Some of the classrooms, they have a little holy water font. And similar to what we do when we walk into the church, and you can dip your finger in that as you come in or go out of the classroom. A lot of families will put that in bedrooms, and especially for the children, so they can, every time they go in and out of their bedroom, they bless themselves. And just a reminder of their baptism, they were baptized. And you remind them of that then too, especially, we got a little one. Why are you dipping your finger in that holy water font? Because you're baptized. Act like it. This is another example here. My mother, in our house, we had the fonts, and they're small, so they only put a little hole, it only holds a little bit of holy water, but it would evaporate real quickly. So my mother gave up and tried to keep them full. And so what she did is she put a bottle of holy water in all of our bedrooms. And when we were younger, what they would do then is as we crawled in, they would tuck us in, say our prayers and stuff beforehand, but then tuck us in, and then they would take that holy water and just make a big sign of the cross over the bed with us in it. And growing up in Wisconsin, during the middle of winter, it seemed that holy water bottle sat under on a dresser or whatever, which often sat near a window. And so that water was freezing cold as it hit your head. But you knew you were going to bed with Jesus. So it was just a nice little reminder that I still have a bottle of holy water at my bedside. I don't bless myself, but I do bless the bed. And it's not by a window, it's not cold. But just, just little customs like this here, little traditions. Just a few Sundays, three Sundays ago, Palm Sunday, you get the palm, and you typically put that in here, but a lot of times people will put it over their crucifix, kind of tuck it in there, or if there's some religious picture that you have in the house, that they'll stick it so you can see it, but it's kind of stuck there. Again, just a reminder of what Jesus endured for us. You could have, if you have a child that's named after a saint, you have a picture or a statue of that saint in their bedroom again. It's a tradition, too, to have a picture of the Last Supper in a dining room. It was an old tradition. I don't see it very often anymore. that, you know, now they have your the TV, the mounted TV over the fireplace mantle. But years ago, it was you would get a big picture of the Sacred Heart of Jesus and hang that over the mantle. And then when people, if they were putting it up for the first time, they would usually invite the priest who would come in and enthrone the house of the family to the Sacred Heart. That's a little ceremony that you go through the family. And then you would usually bless their house, which is another tradition. And so you would bless the house when they first moved in, and then they could renew that every year on Epiphany. And we do that here. We give out the instruction and a blessed piece of chalk that you mark, and that's, you say these prayers, that renewing the house blessing that happened when you first moved into your house. And then you, it's supposed to be over the front door. You erase the one from last year, and there's a, and it's all on this little sheet of paper here that you can read. That's it's the instructions with the chalk. But you put a plus, meaning it's a little cross, two, in the, you know, this year 2020, and you put J, and it is Caspar Balthazar and Melchior, the names of the three kings. So you put up their initials, CMB, and you put a little cross between each of them, and then at the end, 24, and then another little cross there. And that's what I started to say here earlier. A lot of times, and I was raised with this, I still do that. If I write a letter, and of course I realize a lot of people don't write letters anymore, but if you do write a letter, or like we were instructed in our, like if you were taking notes in class, you put a little plus, like a little plus sign, a little cross, JMJ, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. And then a little plus again, or a little cross. The idea was you were invoking the grace of Jesus and the intercession of Mary and Joseph in that class as you were doing that, or upon the person you're writing to. Again, just more of these little customs. Here, we don't have a bell tower. We did when I was at my old parish, St. Mary's. And it's a custom to pray the Angelus at 6 a.m., noon, and at 6 p.m. The Angelus is just this kind of special prayer. It involves the Blessed Mother, but it reflects. So it's noon that Jesus was hung on the cross. It was, you know, approximately 6 a.m. that Jesus rose from the dead. And it was supposedly 6 p.m. that the angel appeared to Mary and said she would would conceive and give birth to the Son of God. And it's reflective of that, of those three times. And so, you know, in a lot of these older churches, and again, St. Mary's is the oldest church in the state of Virginia, founded in 1795. And, you know, here we became a parish in 1999. They built this building in 2005. But that church was founded in 1795. The current church they're in was built in 1826. It's got this nice bell tower. We did not ring the bells at 6 a.m. because people in the neighborhood complained. But we did at 12 and 6 p.m. And actually, we still had some complaints around the 6 p.m. too, that we were disturbing their supper and dinner. We still did it. And the police didn't say anything about it, so we were fine. One other, you know, the kind of more spiritual, or medals, having like a scapular or a medal, and you have one popular medal. I mean, you might have like a patron saint, if you are named after a saint, that medal. I mean, my first name is Dennis. I don't have a medal of St. Dennis on, but some people will wear a medal of their patron saint. I do have a miraculous medal on right now. And that's the Blessed Mother. There's great stories about the miraculous medal. It's called a miraculous medal for a reason. I mean, miracles have happened with people that have been wearing the miraculous medal. And as an example of that, and this is not, I mean, it's not that long ago, but it happened in Baltimore. There was a woman, and, you know, in some of the, one of the, unfortunate neighborhoods where there was a lot of crime,
elderly woman. She was walking down the street, had her purse, and somebody came up and tried to rob her, steal her purse. Foolishly, probably, she tried to kind of fight with the guy. He pulled out a gun, and he shot her. And, I mean, literally, she fell to the ground. He got the purse, and he ran. And he shot her in the chest. But the miracle here, she was wearing a miraculous medal. I mean, she was stunned and wounded in the sense of had a bruise, I should say. But the bullet did not penetrate. It hit the metal. And so it was the force of the bullet that, bruised her, but actually, and knocked her to the ground. But her life was spared. And it was because of that miraculous metal. It literally hit the metal. And I remember I had a guy. He was a D.C. police officer. He was a groom, one of my grooms I was preparing for marriage. And so the patron saint of police officers is St. Michael. He's the protector against evil. And so this guy had a great devotion to St. Michael. And he wore a medal of St. Michael. But he was telling me, he said, like a good day, he was on this power shift. He worked, that late, kind of early to late evening. And he said, a good day is if you didn't get shot at. Basically, but he told me the one case where one night he got a call that there was a robbery in progress. He's in a squad car. He pulls up, and right as he pulls up across the street from the place, the business that was being burglarized, the burglars come out, and they had guns. And he parked his car and got out of his car, drew his gun, and they just started firing at him. And he said he just completely froze, which, obviously they're not supposed to do. And with the way everything was happening, as he got out of the car, he didn't put it in the park. And so he said literally the car rolled away from him. And so he said, I'm just face to face with these guys as they're running out, shooting at him. And he said, literally, they're shooting at me. He said, I completely froze. But he said, I'm watching the bullets drop right in front of his face. And he said, as I'm watching that, even though I froze, I could feel the medal of St. Michael on my chest. And he said, I fully believe St. Michael protected me that day from those bullets being shot at me. So again, some of the the wearing of that, the scapular is a green, or there's different colors, but the most popular is the brown, and there's a piece of cloth or two pieces of cloth. They usually have a Mary on the one side. That's, depending on the one you have, it has different. You got one there. There's a small one. Yeah. That is a scapular. I can dig mine out here too. But mine's a little bigger, but that's mine. but the idea of the scapular is it goes back years ago. It was actually kind of there's similar stories for the rosary, but the scapular. So you had, again, many years ago. We're talking hundreds of years ago. People couldn't read, so they couldn't participate. They couldn't pray. I mean, they could memorize prayers. But they couldn't read, but they wanted to participate with those, because typically the people who could read were the monks and sisters and nuns, because they were taught that, and they would work land and stuff too, but they weren't raising a family, so they had, in some ways, they had more time to do this, but people wanted to kind of participate in the life of the monk or the nun, and who wore this habit, so they would wear a habit, and typically what they would do. It'd be another piece of cloth, long piece of cloth, with a hole in the middle, and it was called a scapular. They slipped it over; it was almost like an apron, and it hung down. It had no sides, so it was just a flat or a piece of cloth with a hole right in the center. And so you flipped it over your head, and one piece hung down the front, one piece hung down the back,
and was actually supposed to protect your habits. And because it was easy to replace that one piece of cloth versus your whole gown that you're wearing here, that's what a habit is. So they would wear, and it, the reason they call it a scapular, it rested on your shoulders, your scapular bone. And so they would go to the lay people then, the non-monks, non-nuns, would wear that, which was a small, it was a kind of a version of that piece of scapular. And
do you wear it like anything?
Yeah, the two pieces, one in the front, one in the back. Yep, like that. Yeah, like that. And it was, again, kind of a short version, if you will, of that scapular. So they were kind of connecting themselves to the religious life of these nuns and monks. That's the same concept with the rosary. And then John Paul, a number of years ago, when he was still living, obviously, he added, so there's been a long time, three sets of mysteries, joyful, sorrowful, and glorious. He added the luminous mysteries to that. But the concept originally, maybe when you heard about the Blessed Mother, maybe they talked about this, I don't know, it was in a class with you. But the original background of the rosary, there's 10 Hail Marys that go with each of those sets of mysteries. So there's, again, so the original three, you know, joyful, sorrowful, glorious, there were five mysteries that were in each category here. So five joyous, joyful, five sorrowful, five glorious. And then you said 10 Hail Marys for each of them as you thought about that mystery. And so 10 times 5 times 3 is 150. How many psalms are there in the Bible? 150. What do those monks and nuns have to pray every day? Every priest, I have to do this too. Mother Machado, every one of us. We have to pray the psalm. We pray the breviary, which is made mostly up of psalms. So the these priests and monks, or these monks, which were priests, and nuns were sisters, they would be praying this 150 psalms over the course of the month. And for over a 4-week period, and so the people couldn't read the Psalms, but they could memorize a Hail Mary, and they would say that Hail Mary 150 times, whether it was they might only do 50 in a day, but over the 3 days they would have 150, and that was how they were participating in the prayer of the church, and that breviary that we have to pray. There are lay people that pray it too. You can get a short version of it. You can get the full version of it. And again, there are people that do that. I know a number of people that do. And you're not required to, but you can. A couple of quick things here. One thing that we do, and actually will be coming up in July, is a lot of parishes tie it to their patronal feast day. Or St. Veronica's feast day is July 12th. And so for 3 days before that, we start. So we'll end on the evening of the 12th. And it's all day the 11th, and it starts the evening of the 10th. We have what is called a 40-hour celebration. And so the Blessed Sacrament, we already have exposed in the church, typically Monday through Friday, from about 1 p.m. until 8:30 a.m. Through the night. But during the 40 hours, it's out on the altar for all 40 hours. And the connection of why 40 hours, it is believed that Jesus was in the tomb literally 40 hours. We say 3 days, but it was literally 40 hours. And so that's where that comes from. And, there's other prayers you can say. So there's the rosary. There's novenas. Novena comes from the word nine. It's 9 days, or it could be 9 weeks, or 9 months even, of prayer. And the nine comes from when Jesus ascended into heaven on the 40th day, he said he would send his Holy Spirit. On the 50th day, the Holy Spirit came upon those apostles in that upper room. How many days were they in there waiting for that? 9 days. That's where the novena comes from. And so that's there's different novenas that you can say. We were saying the Divine Mercy novena leading up to yesterday. So it started on Good Friday, ended on Saturday, this past Saturday. And then, you know, then there's chaplets. There's the Divine Mercy chaplet that actually Jesus gave to St. Faustina, Sister Faustina at the time, in Poland, 1931, and said, you know, promote my mercy, my Divine Mercy with this chaplet, with this novena, with the second Sunday of Easter, designated as the Divine Mercy Sunday. And then she wrote a diary kind of too of all those, you know, what Jesus told her. So, you know, there's that kind of things. I mean, people will have holy cards. You know, you usually pick that up when there's a deceased person. They'll have a little prayer and some maybe, sometimes they put a picture of the person on, sometimes not, but they'll usually have the birth date and the death date. And I have a whole, you know, big collection of them from the different, all my relatives that have died, and, you know, and other friends and priests and things like that I know. Let's see. You know, one thing, just real quickly, too. In church downstairs, you know, we have those four discs, round pictures on the walls of the church, two on one side, two on the other side. And it comes from the book of Revelation. But if you look at them, I wouldn't say they're the best depiction of it all, but so there's, you know, four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so Matthew is, if you're facing the altar, Matthew is the first one, Mark, Luke, John. And so there is a picture of basically the saint, or the Gospel writer, and then the symbol that represents him. And so so Matthew, and his gospel begins with the whole genealogy of Christ. So the whole history of mankind, if you will. So it's a man. And then Mark, his gospel starts with John the Baptist roaring in the desert, proclaiming the coming of Jesus. That's why it's a lion. And then Luke, he was a doctor. And so he spends a lot more time talking about all the sacrifices that Jesus made, the suffering that he endured. And what was the animal of sacrifice? Oh, you know, it was a lamb eventually. That represents Jesus. But the sacrifice for the Jews was like an ox or a bull. So it's an ox is the picture there. And then John's gospel is the one that's just very theological. It kind of soars above the rest of them in that sense. So it's an eagle. But all four of those symbols, the man, the lion, the ox, and the eagle, are all mentioned in the book of Revelation as the sign of the Word of God. And so that's why those pictures are on the walls downstairs.
Also, those four symbols were used to represent the four different sets of three tribes and 12 tribes of Jews.
True, right. Yeah. Yeah, very good. One other quick little thing, again, these are all these little things, but the bishop, and if you were to come here next Tuesday night for confirmation, he always wears he carries a crozier and he wears a mitre. So that's a sign of the office of bishop. The mitre is that hat. It looks kind of like when it's pointing towards heaven, and again it's symbolic of and it's similar to what the Jews would wear too, their religious leaders, but then the staff, he's a shepherd, and, you know, following in the footsteps of the good shepherd, the shepherd Jesus Christ, they carry a staff, a crozier, and so that's why the bishop always, in any official capacity, he's got his crozier in them too. I mean, there's, again, lots more. Oh, you know, one of the other things, I mean, we engage our senses, too. So that's why, you know, beautiful music, incense, smell, sounds, the bells. Oh, that's the music again. The sights, you know, what the statues and things like this, the crucifix itself, you know, during Lent, the last 2 weeks, Passion Time, covered in purple. It's the starkness, the flowers, the candles represent Christ, the light of Christ. All these things are, you know, engaging our, probably not so much of touch, but you know, engage our senses, even in the rituals, the Mass itself, the prayers we say, And so it's you know, involving, in a sense, the whole body. You know, sometimes you'll see, real quickly here too, like you'll see a pelican. And we have one of those on the wall at St. Mary's. The pelican is the pelican feeds its children, its offspring. It pecks at its own self and feeds their own offspring with blood, their own blood. Who feeds us with their blood? Jesus Christ. So the pelican is a symbol that you'll see in some churches. It's a symbol of Christ. You'll often see, you know, again, I said that JMJ, Jesus, Mary, Joseph, you know, like on the cross. Well, you have the INRI, Jesus, you know, the I in Latin is a J. So Jesus, the Nazarene, Rex, King of the Jews. Another thing you'll often see is IHS. And I, again, for Jesus. H for humanum, which means mankind. And then the S for Salvator. Jesus, the Savior of mankind, or of human beings. Sometimes you'll see AMDG in different places too. And it is Latin for ad majorem Dei Gloria, to the greater glory of God. And so people sometimes write that on things too. I'm doing this to the greater glory of God. All right. I think that's everything I want to say on that. Okay, so that, I'm already over. So I knew who was going to do this. Sorry about that. But real quickly, you know, I said, you know, to continue, you know, deepening your faith. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, there's a lot of new stuff. There's a lot of classics. Just to throw a couple of these things out at you real quickly. Introduction to the Devout Life is written by St. Francis of the Sales. It's a basic explanation of the spiritual life. It's somewhat dated with the examples that he gives, but the principles are timeless. And it's if you're really looking for a good book to just kind of start your faith or deepen that now that you've already started, that's a good book for that, Introduction to the Devout Life. A step above that is The Soul of the Apostolate, which tells us how to live that faith a little more deeply. If you're looking for something to do with Mary, another traditional, you know, classic, is True Devotion to Mary by St. Louis de Montfort. If you're looking for something that's a little more deep, we got The Confessions by St. Augustine, his whole story of his conversion. It's beautiful, actually. Even if you're looking for just kind of a nice little prayer book, and we gave you a prayer book with prayers, but there's another book that's just kind of, it's not a prayer book per se, but it's just got all these kind of little thoughts for the day. And it's an imitation of Christ. In fact, besides the Bible, I don't know if that's still true, but I know a few years ago, I mean like 20 years ago, that was the most popular spiritual book, Imitation of Christ, most widely sold besides the Bible. Should ever certainly have a Bible in your home. Let's see here. If you're looking for good, you know, and there's a lot of different publishers out there, but if you're looking for just some really solid stuff, Ignatius Press is probably one of the best. Sophia Press, Tan Books. Tan Books has reprinted a lot of the old classics. You know, there's others that are, sometimes they're kind of mixed, unfortunately, like Ave Maria Press, that's another one. They got some good stuff, and then they got some crazy stuff in there on their list, too. So, but Ignatius Press, it's always good stuff. Sophia Press publishes new stuff. Tan Books, the problem with Tan Books, I mean, not the problem, but it's not new stuff. It's all classics reprinted. And, yeah, I think we'll leave it at that. Real quickly then, too, I was going to spend a little more time on this, but if you're looking to get involved, that's what this blue sheet is. It's got everything that, nearly everything that we have here going on at St. Veronica's. And it's broken up into different categories. You know, some things won't apply to you. You won't be interested in. But, so, you know, for younger, like it says grades 5 through 12, although we got two college guys that are still doing this, altar servers, and we do go with an all-male thing here. Extraordinary ministers, those that help with distributing communion. Our lectors, those that read at Mass. The people that help with the linens that we use at Mass, laundering them. You know, our choirs. We have the adult choir that's at 10:45. Our youth choir at 9 o'clock. And you sometimes help with the 5. So we have, you might have met Gina. She's our head sacristan. She's got a couple other people that help her. Ushers. In fact, we need ushers right now. If you're interested in that. Then on the next side there, our school, the CCD program, as I mentioned, you know about RCIA. There's a homeschool group, too. Legion of Mary's is kind of a prayer group. Devoted to the Blessed Mother. They meet weekly, though, so it's that can, it might be a bit much for some. We have the parish libraries, probably, there's an NFP, Natural Family Planning, information about that. The parish library is available, the youth apostle for ages grades 6 through 12. Then it's kind of outreach things, too. So Link is a monthly collection, food collection. Mary Mother's apostle do different things, help with different things. So they're going to be the ones sponsoring the talk this coming Saturday night. The meal apostle, I'm not sure how much they're doing that right now. Sandy's not in good health right now. But people were a homebounder or sicker, needed something. They would try to do a network of meals to provide for a family or an individual. Our pro-life apostle is very active. The St. Mother Teresa outreach is our charitable arm, basically, and they do various events to help the poor. We have our nursing homes. We've got a garden project here, which you actually can keep your own garden. If you get a plot, you don't have. And you can give some of that away to the poor as well. And then real quickly, there's a number of different other. We have an over 50 Bible study for women. For those that have adopted, we got our CYO sports. That's an all sports program. We got adoration. I talked about that. We have a It's all in Spanish, so they meet every Saturday night. I was there this past Saturday night. They asked me to be there, but I had somebody, I don't speak Spanish. So one of the women was translating everything to me as I went there. That was an interesting evening. But they are a great group, very devoted. Knights of Columbus, very active in our parish. Luminaries meet on the first Saturday and have kind of like they meet in church for the talk that we have every Saturday for Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. Then they get to attend Mass, pray the rosary, and then have a kind of discussion in the hall. That Man Is You meets every Saturday morning at 6:30. They breakfast 6:30 or 6, and then 6:30 or 7 they actually meet. Lord's Flock meets on Saturday, just the first Saturday, just once a month, and it's a charismatic prayer group. Parish Community Circles has not been very active recently. The Rangers is our scouting organization for, and it's high schoolers though. No, ages 9 to 17. But it's for boys. The girls, we had a girls one too, and kind of collapsed. There's another book club at any age, any male or female. Another thing for families is this thing on Saturday night. What Saturday is it? It's once a month. Might be second Saturday. Vocations can get that vocations crucifix that you should take home and say prayers for vocations. We have for, don't know if that includes anybody here, but if you're a widow or a widower, there's a group for them. There's a group that are not walking on Tuesday mornings. We have the young adult. They're very active, actually. And then we have a young mothers. They're somewhat active. So just, again, a quick overview of some of the things that are going on in the parish here. Get involved so you get to meet people. And hopefully deepen your faith. Any questions? I'm way over. And I said we can get out early. Well, sorry about that. Well, this is my last time in this setting with you. Please, anything else I can do to help any of you, let me know. I'm sure I speak for Father Michelle. I don't have for Deacon. And, Scott as well, and Melissa. But thank you for your interest and time this past number of months. And, it was wonderful. Work with you, and again, it would be my prayers. And if there's anything else I can do, let me know. Otherwise, Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Good night. So, thank you.